Hello, listening people.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the first episode of Sweet and Polish Presents.
I can't hear you.
A new podcast hosted by Ryan and Bartek. I'm Bartek and the other guy's Ryan.
Wow. It's a new era of the podcast where Bartek mutters and I speak articulately.
It's a new era of the podcast because we're just starting. This is episode one, the first ever episode.
It's our first ever episode. Happy anniversary to our first ever episode. It's today.
Actually, well, let's just take a break for a few years.
Okay. And then we will return eventually.
All right, we're back.
Hello, everyone. How are we all doing? I hope you're cheering. I hope you're screaming. I hope you're saying, finally, finally, it's a new year, new me. And it's a new episode of Spit and Polish Presents. But how are our two hosts, who are men and have made it into the top 80 two men podcasts list of podcasts?
Now, just to be clear, it's top 80. Two men podcasts on 82.
Yeah, that's it. Top. That's thank you.
Also,
I did say it like that. Yeah. I did say it properly, but
also,
you have to specify.
Also, I checked the list and I think it only goes up to 76.
No. I checked it again. It does go up to 80.
Okay.
It loads weird.
Right.
So to give clarification, we got an email. Thank you for everyone who emails us over at spitandpolished@gmail.com. If you have questions, queries, concerns, recommendations for films we cover, or you like to let us know that we have made it into the top 80, Bartek, list of two men podcasts that feature two men. Well,
how many times do we have to say two? Two times, because we're 22.
That's it. But we are actually a podcast that goes over films that have been recommended by one of us and or by you, the listening people. It depends what week it is. And we are both spitting young gentlemen. That's the reason why we get into the top 80 two men podcasts.
Well, no, because in the description it's two spitting men.
I know, but I'm saying that it's because distinguished and it's because we're Polish, yeah. Actually. We're both Polish of some variety.
Well, we're only top four for that one.
But we are higher in the list of that.
Well, it's the top 10, so.
But we are higher.
I think fraction-wise we're actually a bit lower.
Don't say that. Don't think it. But Bartek, what is going on? So a movie's been recommended. Was it you that recommended the movie?
No, Ryan, don't you remember 3 months ago you recommended the film for this episode?
We have been on a longer break than expected. It just kept happening. Every time we were going to come back to watch this movie and talk about it, I went on a trip or I got sick or school started again, so things are a bit more hectic, or we chose just to hang out and do other things that don't get to happen as often as when we do the podcast, like, oh, our friends are free, let's do this thing, or hey, let's go see a movie in the cinema itself. Like, fun fact, Bartek and I, along with my wife Rachel, we saw Godzilla Minus One in the cinema, and we saw The Holdovers. That was a lovely little date.
Yeah, it was.
And that stopped us from talking about Decision to Leave, a film that I actually recommended. Yes, I pitched this to the podcast at the end of last year, and we're here to talk about Decision to Leave. If people have not seen the film, we recommend that you do watch it for yourself. We are going to get into more details, more depths, and spoilers, and all of that stuff as we discuss it. But for those who are just needing a little bit more of a logline, a little bit more of a summary or pitch of this film, Bartek, how would you do that? How would you propose this film to someone who is not familiar with it, but maybe you're wanting them to check it out?
So the premise of this film is that the main character is a insomniac cop. He's always going on stakeouts because he can't sleep. And he takes his job very seriously. He's married to a woman, but because she works far away and he's always busy, they only get to see each other once a week. So he's not having necessarily the greatest life, but he's getting by. And the latest case that he gets involved with involves a man who fell off a cliff while he was, you know, mountain climbing, and leaving behind a immigrant Chinese widow. who he investigates under suspicion that, like, maybe she had something to do with it. And along the way of his investigations, he falls for her, and it becomes about, you know, their sort of relationship and how his feelings get in the way of the investigation, makes him cut some corners, become a bit more biased, and, you know, leading to a roller coaster or a slippery slope of, you know, bad things happening, especially in the latter half.
And yet his personal life improves, his career as an investigator, as a cop, as an enforcer of the law, becomes muddier, but him as an individual, he sleeps better, he gets happier, he has drive, he has something beyond just the archetypical detective who must solve a case, who must look at the pictures on his wall that are unresolved murders or cases or suspects. And that is Decision to Leave in a bit of a nutshell. It goes into some more depth and interesting places that we will start to get into now. Now, with Decision to Leave, I saw this in the cinema. I was very excited to see it. I love this director. He has made many great films, some of which we have covered on this podcast. He is obviously well known for doing Old Boy, but in more recent times, he did Stoker, which we covered on the podcast. His only English language film. But I bring that up because this movie has a lot of those visual flourishes that Stoker had. While then after that, something that we also did on the podcast, what one did he do, Bartek? Come on.
Did he do Stoker before The Handmaiden?
Mm-hmm. Handmaiden was the one he did right before this.
I guess I'm biased because I'm just...
2016?
Right. I guess I'm mixed up because we did The Handmaiden first, yes. So I just assumed it was first.
He did The Handmaiden, which is a fantastic film. Everyone, please go watch The Handmaiden. It's one of the greats. It's so good. But I'm a big fan of this director. I like his style. I like his attitude. And I was hearing good word of mouth about this one. And I also really appreciated the discussion that he was having as a director, as was the people who have seen the film, about how this is a different tact for him. It's not focusing in on the sexual stuff or the violence or all of these things that he's very much well known for. Like, if you aren't aware, if you haven't seen Old Boy, you may hear of its gruesome reputation, like the one-shot scene where it's all violent, or the sexual stuff in Handmaiden. And this particular film, although it does skirt around those things, it doesn't dive into the water of it like his other films. It's him coming at certain subjects with a very steady and restrained manner. And I wanted to see that. I wanted to see what this would come across as with that in mind of my familiarity with what he's done before. Like, if you see his vampire movie, it's so horny and violent and funny. And this Decision to Leave has a lot of the hallmarks of what we have watched of his on the podcast, but it's presented in a far more, again, restricted, conservative, very deliberate manner, a lighter touch, but also a deliberate, again, very, like, it's almost clockwork precision.
I was going to say, yeah, you said lighter touch, and I was thinking, like, yeah, it's not, I wouldn't exactly call it a dark film.
No.
Yeah.
So that is it, and I saw this in the cinema with my wife and some friends, and I was the one who enjoyed it the most. My wife liked it well enough. She laughed her head off at the turtle scene where he gets his fingers bit. And Bartek has been in the cinema now with my wife as she laughs her head off, and it's quite literally the experience.
You literally just talked about the holdovers before.
Mm-hmm. And I remember that vividly, but I enjoyed the film more than everyone else. Rachel liked it quite a bit, and our two friends didn't really care for the movie, found it too slow, too plodding, too just middle of the road. But what about you, Decision to Leave? You are familiar with this director since we have covered some of his material on the show, but tell us a bit more about your experiences with this film and the people involved.
Yeah, I forgot that he did Stoker until I looked it up just the other night. I'm like, oh, yeah, that's right. That was the thing where, you know, he did an English language film. I liked it fine. I didn't love it, but this also feels like one that, like, if I rewatch it, I feel like I'm going to have a better time with it. I know that with the Handmaiden, we rewatched it again a couple of months ago, and I didn't love it as much as I did the first time. This one I feel like would improve on a rewatch, and I'm also keen to go through this episode and, you know, talk about it a bit more, maybe appreciate it a bit more.
Did you have any expectations or wants, desires, things in mind when coming into Decision to Leave? Did you know anything?
To be honest, not really all that much. I think I may have read a synopsis weeks ago, because this is how long the episode's been in the making for, where it was about someone investigating a crime and falling in love with a suspect. But other than that, not really much else, other than like logical things like, oh, is she guilty? Is she not? Will that get in the way? Not really. And throughout the film, there are a couple of times where I had to pause and, you know, go to the toilet or whatever, and seeing like, oh, wow, there's still like half the film left. There's still a third of the film left. Where's it going to go? There was, intrigue there about where it's going to go from there. And in fact, one point where it feels like the film was going to end, it's like, nope, we're cutting 13 months later.
It has a very, and I say this as a positive, but it has a very episodic nature to it. Yes, there is a major thrusting point of this blossoming relationship that is most likely a manipulation on both of their parts, not just hers, and the questioning of did she actually commit a murder or not. But when the film plays out, there is, I don't know, there's just this certain comfiness it has, a slice of life feel, yet it's very much within the genre of like your detective and your romance. But with these kind of vignettes, like you said, like, here we are, we're halfway through the movie, things are going to wrap up, and then bam, no, we're going to do other things. And I think it all weaves together nicely, but this isn't a standard storytelling method.
I was going to say, cause you mentioned episodic nature. I've literally never watched one before, but I was thinking of the concept of, like, you know, dramas and like K-dramas and stuff like that. I could see this being adapted, or even maybe even edited differently to fit that format.
Oh, of course. And you have characters that come in and out as the movie goes along, like his partner at the beginning, and then he gets a new partner in the second half, and they're drastically different people, and yet they have to serve the same function to our main character, which is the person who gets fed up with the main character's bullshit after various points. But Decision to Leave is a very interesting little film. I mean, it goes on for a while. It's nearly basically 2.5 hours long. But one thing that I always find interesting about the cop procedural detective, the noir-esque stories, is the often recurring thing of the femme fatale.
Mm-hmm.
The woman who the lead is infatuated with. They are romantically drawn to them, but they also like them on an intellectual level. If you go back in time to earlier cinema, like your 1930s, those roles, the femme fatale roles, were the more interesting ones to see actresses play out, because the female characters were written with agency and determination, intellect. But obviously there's statements to be made about how it's also they're being duplicitous, and can you trust them, and sexuality is being used in this way to weaponize in this situation. But I do love, I'm a sucker for that. I'm a sucker for the femme fatale and our detective, our cop, whoever it is. And this central relationship is not unique. You have seen this in many movies before, or many stories before, but it's about the presentation, it's about the execution, and it's about the thematic stuff it's still exploring. And did you feel this as well? I know you're not as versed in some of these noir stories, but how do you go about the conceit of the movie being a little bit more of a standard of what you may see in many stories like this?
Honestly, I wasn't really thinking about the concept of femme fatale while watching the film, but definitely that is what's going on there. I think because, you know, we were even saying before that this isn't necessarily, you know, a standard execution of, you know, the genre. it did feel very light. This character that he's falling in love with could, in one lens, be seen as the villain of the film, because it's very likely that she is the mastermind, or well, not maybe not even mastermind, but like a big player in the crimes that he's solving. But the film is focusing on quite largely the positive impact she has on his life. A big part of this film is that our detective character is married.
Mm-hmm.
He does seem...
to a loving wife.
To a loving wife.
That he doesn't care about.
That he doesn't care about, but who cares about him very, very much. And there is, you know, whenever you have a film about someone who's cheating or who's seeing another woman on the side or seeing another man on the side, there is this inherent, not desire, but this inherent thing in you that if you especially do not approve of, you know, two timing or going back on your partner's mm-hmm. back. I'm failing with my words.
You've been out of whack, out of practice. Let me bring you in.
Let's breathe.
You're basically talking about like the moral and ethical quandaries of when you watch a narrative, especially if it's through the lens of a main character who is a cheater. How do you respond to that?
How do you
especially
respond to it? Yeah.
If the relationship that they're having with the person they're cheating with is positive impact on them personally. You feel bad for his wife because she's a good person. She has done nothing wrong, and he has just become... this is also a midlife crisis movie.
Yeah,
he's a middle-aged man who has got to a position in life with his job, with his wife, where everything is just plodding along. Nothing's progressing. And then he meets a woman.
All of that is complementary to what I was trying to say, which is that there is an inherent desire in you to not approve of this. This is our main character. He's cheating on his wife. You know, you're probably likely going to be against him on that. And the film, in some ways, it does make you feel that way. But in other ways, you are seeing the positive impact that what he's doing is having on his life. So, yeah, there is a sort of conflict in you, and that's really interesting to watch.
With noir, with detective stories, with cop stories, with things like this, and forbidden romance, it's about that voyeurism. It's about that sensationalism as well, because even outside of their romantic and sexual entanglements with one another, you also get the thrill of them having to solve cases together, and the dynamic most likely being, again, not 100% confirmed in this movie, but the dynamic being a detective and a murderer work really well together to stop other murderers. That's fun. Like, you're like, yeah, that's really fucked up and weird and interesting. It's not just he's a good guy cop who's going to just work real hard. No, it's almost like he's cutting a corner ethically to be able to do his job. And he's also pairing that with, this is their sick way of having dates after a certain point. Like, this is their way of getting jiggy with it, is her coming over and being like, well, I noticed this thing. And it's like, yes, if you are in fact a criminal mastermind, you would know how to do these things. I just, that's really fun. Like, that's something where, and you said it, we've mentioned it, there's a lightness. This film is very funny. Like, it's comedic, it's very humorous, and it's not just the dialogue or the acting, but the visuals, like the camera and editing,
yeah.
But it's not, and I want to emphasize this for many people, you hear Asian cinema, you think, oh, it's going to be wacky, zany. Not at all. It's almost like Hitchcockian, the way it executes its visuals. And Hitchcock movies were very funny at times as well. Like, Psycho had very funny scenes in it as well. But this film's, like, editing style is very humorous at times. Like, you just hard cut to something else, and it kind of just jolts you, and you go, oh, that's kind of... that, like, he's at the height of all of this, like, insanity going on with a case, and then a phone call happens, and then cut to him chasing a guy who has turtles on the back of his motorcycle. He's like, I guess we're doing this now. It's just, it's very interesting like that. What did you think of its tonal like juggling act and atmosphere.
There was a lot of stuff in this that really appealed to me. Yeah, like you said, I'm not too as familiar as with noir stuff as you, but I have played a lot of video games that focus on like murder mysteries and stuff like that. And often, you know, with the medium of games, you have different ways of communicating with the player. You know, you'll have a lot of internal monologue and you have to communicate things to the player differently. And I feel like this film kind of did some of those stylistic things where like the detective would, when he would be imagining the situation, he would imagine himself as like being in the scene itself, like having a close look at something, even if it's just hypothetical. I really like that angle, that
like
that
the ashtray
decision. Yeah. The ashtray. I think he did it again at the pool. He did it a couple of times. I really liked also, this might have been one of my favorite parts of the film, just because it was a neat little thing that communicated quite a few things. It's when he was texting the girl, the love interest, about going to see her, the granny, who, yes, on her behalf. And it's a shot focusing on his phone. And she's like agreeing, like, okay, I'll let you do this for me. And then he's typing a response and you're like reading the response. And then she sends another message. So he goes back. And it's just a really like alternative way of character getting interrupted mid-sentence and then having to then react to the next thing that's being said.
And then he's trying to write this really long reply and then he has to stop because he sees the bubbles, yeah, like the typing, and then he just writes okay.
Yeah, and he keeps backspacing and yeah, the subtitles like tell you what he was in the middle of typing. She says the next thing and then he changes it. It was just really funny and also, yeah, really good. And when I read the trivia about how the director was like really against, like, ooh, I don't really want to do text message stuff. I'm like, oh, that's a shame because that was one of my favorite parts of the film.
I can understand the concern for it because it can be very corny, the texting stuff in movies. Like in the late 2000s to 2010s, thanks to things like Sherlock, the television shows, and the Social Network and whatnot, it became very trendy to do like ways of texting to make it cool in movies, and it just becomes corny. But
yeah, new media in general.
I can't remember. I believe this is one of those scenes, but there's many scenes where the point of view is from the phone, like we're inside of the phone
and you see,
looking at him, and we get an overlay. This movie uses overlays in various fashions. Like one of my favorite shots in this is we get like this pan transition, like it's just like a swipe transition where in a previous scene and the camera just swoops to the right and now our main detective is in the center of the frame, overlaid behind him is like text messages and writing like his reports and like all of this stuff, like
indicating
like this is how his mind and brain and body works when he's on the case. And yet he is in the center of the frame as this still stoic image where he's just focused. And I loved all of that. I love that. And there's just so many moments of that. That, like, for me, the tone of this movie is very humorous, but it's got this overwhelming like sense of loss and sentimentality and romance. And it's very dreamy. Especially when you get to the second half where they go to a physical location that has aesthetics of a dream, where he has to live in a town that has all of this mist and fog, and it just gives you that extra push that his life is not real almost. Like one of my favorite visuals is him on the mountaintop with her spreading the ashes, and he's near the cliffside and you're worried, is she going to push him? But behind him, you just see her body's now just a silhouette and her head is just this big source of light because she has one of those little, you know...
They're like the mining helmet with the torch.
Yeah, the little torch on the head thing for when you're climbing. And it's almost like she just doesn't have a face anymore. She just is just like this very abstract image of like an attractive woman's body, but their head is just this beam of light. And it's just one of those where it's like, this is just, you wouldn't have gotten that in the first half of the film. Like the first half lives in this more kind of gritty, almost Hitchcockian feel. And then it slowly becomes, you know, not David Lynch-esque, but more like Terrence Malick, where it's just foggy and dreamy and ethereal.
It parallels with like his ability to sleep, because in the first half, very insomniac. Second half, you know, he's sleeping a little bit better.
And it was just so great when it came to those. I thought it balanced those tonal shifts really well. Like there was moments where I was laughing hysterically. I'm like, this is really funny. To then taking me into a scene of genuine poignancy. I'm just left there stroking my chin almost at the things that these two characters are philosophizing about and going over. Like when they had their little romantic dates and they're walking around. I can't remember what the area was. They're like in this little museum or whatever it is, and like banging the drums and they're talking to each other.
The Buddhist temple,
yes, the Buddhist temple. Yeah. And then she says some bad stuff in front of Buddha. It's like, in front of Buddha, no less. It's like very funny.
Yeah.
But around that scene is her tenderly listening to his recordings until she gets up to a bit that's very upsetting to hear. And then it's really awkward and almost tense. Like, is this the turning point of their relationship going sour as she's listening to his very judgmental, voyeuristic takes on her life, which at the beginning of this was very cute and now it's not so much. Like, I just love how this film just keeps swerving in these ways where, like, you feel comfortable, yet you don't feel comfortable with how the movie is going to go with this stuff. What were some things that leapt out to you or you appreciated or things that you want to note down in this discussion about Decision to Leave?
Well, I've already talked about the sort of internal thought processes that he had, putting himself in the scene. Those aspects, the text message scene. I guess in that sense, yeah, visual communication. The film was just really strong. And I think, yeah, we even talked about at the beginning that editing was a big part of this one. What else was there? I guess in terms of something that I struggled to follow a little bit, there were a couple of like side cases that he was doing while the film was happening.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly about like abusive boyfriends and stuff like that. I found some of them a little bit tricky to follow. Sometimes I was mixing them up, like, oh, this guy's back. Wait, no, it's a different guy.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that. Yeah, that was a bit of a weakness for my viewing. But in general, you know, it all tied together.
I like that at the beginning, he gets a phone call. He comes in to talk to this woman who, I can't remember, like, does she, like, run one of those, like, internet cafes or something or other? And she says, like, oh, this person that you're looking for came in. I thought I'd give you a call about it because I recognize she's all, like, this noble civilian. And at the beginning of this film, you get this sense because of his status as a cop that he's not solving any important cases. He's just doing local misdeeds. Like, he has his partner who's this joke with the massager. He has like the female detective or cop lady in the office and his boss, and like there's almost this sensation that we have come into this cop's life where nothing of note is happening. Thus he goes out in the night when he can't sleep to do stakeouts so that he can have something worth being a cop over. But then we find out that no, that's actually not the case. Like, that woman who called him was calling him about a guy who killed another person because he's severely jealous of this woman he likes. And then that person eventually he tracks down thanks to his ongoing relationship with a lead female character. And I loved how it did that, where It's almost like it's like the film constantly is asking you, are you being tricked? Like, is our lead character being tricked, and are you being tricked by the allure of the people involved, whether it is the cop himself or the femme fatale or this or that? And that was one of those where at the beginning I was just like, oh, he's having to solve like some petty crimes, but then no, it isn't. That's not it at all. And then when he moves, that's when he has to become the guy who just solves petty bullshit until there's a celebration of a murder.
Congratulations,
honey.
It's a murder case.
It's a murder. That was very good. Like, that guy that eventually he tracks down who kills himself because he would rather die than go to jail. Like, that's who was being discussed about at the beginning, but it felt like for the first chunk of the movie, like, oh, it's just some petty thief that our main guy just can't get a handle on, like he can't find him. And then
that was the aspect that I was a bit lost on, because I remembered that character's name.
Mm-hmm.
And then when he came back, it seemed like it was a completely different thing. I'm like, wait, did I miss something?
Yeah, and him getting, and our main cop having to like chase people down that's involved with that one dude, like he gets into a knife fight. Our main character, I love that scene of like how pathetic it is. Just they're running and they're all out of breath and our cop is like, hold on, hold on. And he's like putting on the gloves so that way the metal glove so he doesn't get stabbed. He can grab the knife and just, it's not to say that it was a gentlemanly fight, but it's very much like not at all cinematic.
Once he gets the advantage, like, let go of the knife so I can stop beating you. And it just goes on for like another minute.
And she's watching it in her car. At first she's concerned, then she's relieved, then she's turned on, and then she's bored because it just keeps going on for so fucking long. Oh, man. I'm giggling because it's like, that's funny. That's like very, very funny. But the humor of this movie rarely is telling you to laugh. That's like the sweet spot for me.
Yeah,
like,
I think I only laughed like once, but it was quite amusing at points.
Yeah, it has an amusing thing. Like I loved another thing, and this is something I want to ask you. His first partner has this debate with him about if she was just an ugly woman, older lady, or if she was a man.
Yeah, average Korean man.
Would you give them the benefit like you are now? And he denies this and denies this. What do you think? By everything we go through in this movie, what do you think about a lead character's like moral and ethical quandaries he finds himself in, and that wrestling match between what it is to be someone who has to have that and also someone who is a person with feelings? Because that's kind of the tug of war he's going through, is do I be the cop or do I be the man?
No, I think his partner was right in that aspect. I think, yeah, the fact that he has an attraction to this woman is what, you know, fueled the bias that he went with. And I like that even though that partner was quite goofy in a lot of cases, you had that one scene where, you know, he laid it out as it is.
That guy did not have a good time. He got stabbed a bunch.
In the scene we were just talking about before, the knife fight, like he established at the beginning of that whole sequence, like, oh, I've got my gun on me. Even if I'm not going to use it, it's going to be useful. And then, you know, he doesn't even catch up to the guy. And the main character tells him, like, what's the point of having a gun if you're not even
gonna
fit?
Use it.
Yeah.
And then he throws the main guy the gun, like, hey, take this. And then, you know, the main guy has a gun for a good portion of the movie, too. There was that very, very, very erotic scene where the main detective is with the femme fatale and they're talking and it's like, will they, won't they? And he gets up and he undoes his belt.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh. And she gives this look like, oh. And then he puts on the holster.
Yeah.
He just has his belt, he puts his belt back on. That was such a perfectly played bit. They didn't need to do that, but they did it. I want to talk about something that's very interesting. I don't think we've ever had this come up on the podcast before. Maybe I'm wrong. We've covered many movies, hundreds of films now. This is a movie that made me think of something that is the beauty of time in movies, where you can manipulate time through editing. You can make things bleed into one another, and through that, you are making a comment in itself. I don't know if you felt this, but many scenes would continue on even though the next scene had started. Or you would have a scene going and the next scene would start before the other one had ended. So, for instance, you have at the beginning of the movie, they're talking about the man and how it could have been a suicide. They're at the mountain, they're looking at him, they're wondering, like, if this is the thing. They're discussing, like, all of this stuff about, like, could this be a suicide? And as they're saying that, we cut to the wife. And it's like they're talking, but like that conversation is still happening as we are now in a new scene. Or many scenes like would start before like the dialogue or just some conversation piece. And it's like, oh, now we're already into the next thing. There's like a muddling of and a blurring between the lines of like when scenes would stop and start. And I thought it was really well done, but it added to this disorientation of like time, like how everything works. Did you experience that or notice that yourself?
So you mean like when it cuts to the new scene, like it sort of continues the topic?
Yeah, or the previous scene is still going through the next scene. Like we have conversations from the previous scene, even though we're on a completely new scene entirely. Like that happened multiple times, or vice versa, where the next scene interrupts where we're at. Like we'll have a conversation between two characters and then a new voice enters the scene and you're like, what's happening here? And then eventually it would move on to where that voice is coming from. Oh, it's from the next scene. Very like shuffling up the deck of how you would do these things.
Maybe I'd have to watch it again to see the execution of it, but no, I didn't really notice it. I feel like that happens in films though.
It happens so much in this, and that's what I mean, like we don't comment on that very often on our podcast. Like it's something where it stood out to me, and on a rewatch it stood out to me as well, because there's this line where one of them says, oh, you think they're the suicidal type, and that line is said as we are shown the femme fatale. So we're in the previous scene. They're leading up like, oh, it could have been a suicide. And then, oh, you think they're the suicidal type. That line is said as we get an image, a shot of the wife. And at the end of the movie, that means something. Because is she the suicidal type? At the end of the movie, she looks as if, and maybe did, kill herself. But at the beginning of the movie, because they're having a conversation about one thing and it leads into the other, it's saying something through that editing choice, through those deliveries of information and words that ring out louder as we go through the through this feature. And it just leapt out at me just so much of how they would just not do the traditional editing where it's not as if just scenes just, well, they said that one line that ties up the scene nicely, clap, clap, cut to the next thing. No, they didn't do that so much. They did it just so, like, esoteric is the way that I would describe it.
Yeah. Atypically.
Atypically, yeah.
I'd have to rewatch it to properly answer that. Because, yeah, you saying, were they the suicidal type in cutting to the wife? That would have a new meaning if I knew the ending.
What did you think of her?
Yeah, like we were saying before, she wasn't played, you know, stereotypically as a femme fatale, to the point that, you know, part of the mystery was like, is she even femme fatale? Is she actually completely honest in what she's saying? And it tried to, it gave her this interesting meld of, not manipulative, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess a more playful version of manipulative, like, ooh, Am I actually this way or am I not? And also, yeah, genuinely worried about the situation.
There's never moments where she doesn't have ambiguity. When you think you know what she's about, then something new will pop up that makes you question the thing that you thought you knew. So there's always like this level of ambiguity and mystique to her. I love, again, love is a word I use a lot here. There's just so many aspects to this, but this is a long film, like 2.5 hours. What do you fill that up with? Is a question that many people debate with movies. Like, how do you justify film length?
To be honest, you talking about 2.5 hours being long, I feel like so many films these days are that I almost...
But people are pushing against that being that kind
yeah,
of the way.
I know, I agree with that too.
And I understand that. But the thing is, what do you fill it up with? And this fills it up with details, lots and lots of details, because you talk about like how you felt about it, but like how do you feel about how much they give us insight and knowledge and backstory and information about who she is? It's like the thing is, she's not just a Korean lady. No, no, she's a Chinese immigrant who came through this way, and they have, like, details about how the language barrier, like, a huge thing of, is she someone we should doubt? One of the things that they flag up is, she is speaking a language that isn't her own, so anything that we may have suspicions about could just be a misunderstanding of Korean.
Yeah, lost in translation.
Yeah, like, she gets to that point where she no longer knows how to express things in Korean, so she grabs out her phone and gets it to translate for her. Like, I just... That's why I appreciate the kind of methodical nature to this of, like, him making a profile for a case. It's like she is becoming a fully rounded person to us, but at the same time, we're seeing her through the eyes of a detective, of a cop, who is trying to determine if she's good or bad, if she's guilty or innocent, if she's worthy of cheating on his wife for or not. And so all of these details feel like they're bias as well from our lead, because, like, do you think that she was a mastermind? Do you think she was a bad person? Do you think any of these things? Or do you think that she just was someone who was in the wrong place at the wrong time? Or what is your feelings on her in that fashion?
I mean, she did play a role in murder, so she's definitely not straight up good. Wouldn't go as far as mastermind, but yeah, certainly immoral.
But she justifies it with moral reasonings.
Mm-hmm.
And do you, as an individual, find that good enough? Do you find the idea of euthanasia, because that's what her argument is.
Yeah.
It was euthanasia. I didn't murder. I did it with permission. So it's good. And our lead character thinks it's good for a while until... he witnesses it again, like with, what was it, Slappy, whatever the name was, Slaps, the criminal who's always slapping people. His mother, she used the fentanyl on her. And then that's when our lead character's like, oh no, I'm not on board with her killing people.
Well, yeah, with her mother, even though it might not have been done through, you know, official legal means, there was a moral justification there. But with the other one, you know, it was leading up to, you know, getting this guy to commit murder. It was an inciting.
But again, that's also, she argues that wasn't her reasoning for doing that. And do you believe that? Do you believe that? Because you just said, I don't think she's a mastermind, but if you believe that she did that so that would happen, that's mastermind behavior.
Well, with that one, then I suppose, yeah, it would be masterminding.
And then if you believe that, but you don't think, like, how much does your suspension of disbelief for certain things go? Like, oh, if she's a mastermind like this, well, maybe she's a mastermind with how the previous husband died on the mountaintop, because we see him figure out how she could have done it, how she could have killed the husband on the mountaintop. Do you think she killed him?
I think so.
Right. And yet, you were apprehensive to say mastermind for her. Yet everything, if you believe these things, wouldn't you say, like, she is a pretty mastermind, methodical killer?
I suppose so, yeah, you're right.
And yet there's this air of, like, I don't want it because, I'll say it, she's pretty nice. she seems pretty...
Well, she's not a sociopath.
Well, yeah, but maybe she is. Like, that's the thing, maybe she is, and we're just seeing it through the point of view of somebody who wants to love her. Because we see her put on role, like, literally she has the hair extensions and wigs, like she puts on costumes and roles and different personas for who she's interacting with. Like, her version of herself when she's married to this next husband is completely different to the woman that our lead was buying the fancy premium food for.
The premium sushi.
Yeah. I loved how angry his partner got at that. He's like, what the fuck? Come on. Like, you wouldn't let me get the premium shit. Yeah, there's just a lot of ambiguity. And I know you and I talk about this often on the pod with films like this of, like, the, was this real? Was this not? Do you believe this? Do you believe that? That doesn't always drive our interests in movies or stories, but it can for very many people. Like, people talk about Inception. It's like, oh, was it reality? Was it a dream? Oh, the thing still spinning at the end. You and I don't buy into that kind of speculation or fascination as often. It's more about, like, what is that in aid of?
Mm.
Like, what is all of this stuff in aid of? And what do you find to be the case for Decision to Leave, where we end the movie just with our lead character splashing around in the beach, not finding the woman, kind of like haphazardly just blundering his way through, and we're left with no answers to many things, but more questions. But what do you think the overall statements and intention are when it comes to Decision to Leave and how it plays around with a lot of these ambiguous statements?
Gonna have to think about that one a little bit. Let me just replay the end of the film in my head. So she goes to the beach, she digs the hole, she waits for the tide to come in to bury her.
There was a stick in the beach already, like it was pre-planned.
Mm.
Like she marked her spot.
What was happening immediately before all of this?
She was on the phone to him saying that she there was a voice message on the previous husband's phone, like the one who just died,
mm-hmm.
of our lead character saying that he loved her, and yet there was no point where he said,
"Yeah, that was the big question," because he was just constantly trying to work it out. Maybe.
And her idea is, as soon as you said you loved me, that's when your love ended, and it's when mine started.
That was a good line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And now I'm letting you go from being shattered.
I guess in the end, she had maybe some sort of desire to be understood, to be loved, and it wasn't being met, and he didn't understand what she meant, because, like, you know, she said the thing about, like, you said you loved me. And I know that in certain cultures, like, reading between the lines is a much bigger, much more natural thing to do than in a Western setting. So maybe there was a case here where she was reading between the lines of something he said or did and saw that as evidence of, like, oh, saying I love you. He didn't recognize it.
Look at it as, I think the way that this plays out is spectacular. He's the lead actor. He has such a goofy face in this. He has such a, like, he's very expressive, but very goofy at times. And that exaggeration really plays beautifully into the final beats of this, because he's so overwrought, and yet there's a little bit of a, at least to my mind, there's a little bit of a humor and dramatic irony to him circling around where she was. He's right there.
Oh, dramatic irony for sure, yeah.
He's right there, but, like, there's a little bit of a, you brought this on yourself. Like, all of this is on himself as well. Like, and yet he's still missing the forest for the trees. He's running around with his torch, screaming out her name, and he'll never find her, and yet she's right there. Or maybe she's not. But how I look at it is, with everything in this movie, is he, with his insomnia, with his wife leaving him, with this woman potentially killing herself and him not realizing any of this, with him maybe never saying out loud, I love you, but she read into that. It's about how this is a person, this is a man, this is a detective who doesn't see what's right there in front of him. He doesn't realize it. And thus he's left at the end of the movie just running around, still not getting it. Like, he doesn't learn. He doesn't get it. Like, the last thing he says to his wife is basically like, hey, didn't we make a promise that you would still fuck me? And he just doesn't know why that's wrong. And that's how I look at it, where we can talk about if our main, like, relationship is good or bad and if she was actually manipulating him or not. But when it comes to the major thrusting points of them making us question everything in front of us, I think it just hammers home into my mind that he lives like that. He lives wanting everything to be this hard to define, unresolved case. And yet it's not always like that, but he makes every element of his life like that, so that way He doesn't have to come to terms with the things that are right there in front of him. So there he is at the end of the movie, running around with his torch, this ineffective thing. He's screaming at his fellow cops to come here and do this thing right now. Don't question it. Don't question this. Just do it right now because I want you to. That's how I read it. I read it as this vain attempt of a man trying to look at a thing that's right there in front of him, but also he's not actually looking at it. He doesn't see the magic eye picture. Like, you know, he can't adjust. He can't focus in. So yeah, I don't think necessarily he said out loud, I love you to her, but everything he did, everything he said, everything he was participating in was saying that. But he doesn't realize that because he's a dumb guy with a goofy face who gets bitten by turtles and just and he says to his wife, don't you realize you should still fuck me though? Like, he's just this guy who wants to be this romantic, intellectual, philosophical, A-grade cop. But to me, he's just a man. A dumb man who just doesn't get it. That's my read on it. That's my feeling on it. Everything else we can leave up to, like, what do you think conversations. I'm like, what do you think? Do you think she killed the guy? What do you think about this? But it's all in aid of those ambiguous questions, or in aid of, to my read of the movie, that character study of this person who just, he wants everything to be a blur in his life. But when it matters, it shouldn't be, but he still can't put things into focus.
Yeah, this, not as strongly, but the mystery aspects of this film kind of fall in the same line as, like, In the Heat of the Night or Twin Peaks, where it's like, yeah, there is a mystery and there is an answer that you can reach, but it's not really the point.
I thought you were going to compare this to another Korean movie we've done, Burning, which also plays around with that sense of dreaminess, a main character grasping at straws of things that he doesn't understand, and yet it's of his own making. Very different executions.
But I was going to say, I think that's the opposite of what I was going to compare it to.
I don't know. I feel like there's a, you could watch them with one another and there's a communion there, but they have different statements to make. But I feel like the dreamy unansweredness of it all, but they're very, both great films. Check them both out.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
I recommend Decision to Leave. I pitched it for this podcast. And if you're aficionado of this director's work, I think this one is interesting. It's probably one of his lesser films, but I commend the growth. I commend them trying to develop as a voice and trying to challenge themselves instead of just being the guy who continues to do old boy or the guy who continues to do, like, the handmade and, like, high sexual stuff. But you see how this is the same person, like how in Handmaiden it has segments in it and how it plays around, like it's much more cranked up in that than in this. I think this is very much in a kinship with Stoker in a weird way, where it's taking a conventional story type we all know, twisting it a little and having a high degree of visual flourishments to get the points across. This isn't a over-the-top, wacky, zany affair when it comes to editing and visuals, but it's definitely adjusted up a few notches from where you would normally be. So I recommend Decision to Leave. What about you?
I recommend Decision to Leave. I think it's fine. I wish I liked it more, but if you give it a chance and you keep watching it, there are some really nice things going on there on a visual level and also editing. And yeah, our lead characters have a very interesting relationship.
I thought that it's so, I don't know too much about Korea. Like, it's history, it's relationships with other countries.
There's a North one too.
Yes, I know that. But again, I still don't know too much about that dynamic as much. But I have really loved with the Korean movies we have watched with Burning that goes into that dichotomy. And also, like, Korean Americans and stuff like that in Burning. Or with The Handmaiden, how it had the history and relationship of Japan involved there. I have really liked how these movies, and now this one with China involved, how each one of these movies we've watched has given a little bit more of a voice and understanding of Korean culture and its attitudes and relationships to other cultures and nations around it. Like,
they haven't been pure Korean. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, yeah, that's exactly.
Space Sweepers.
Yeah. Yeah. Space Sweepers is another one where, like, that's everyone's involved. But this one, we didn't talk about it too much, but the undercurrent of bigotry towards Chinese people is very much there. Like, there is a, I don't want to say it's unspoken, but it's quietly spoken. The disdain that some Korean people have for Chinese people is very much in this. That's another thing of, like, is that a reason why people don't like her in this? It's all good, but we are now having to hear a recommendation for the next film we are going through, and it is the listening people's choice. And people out there, you can recommend movies to us. You can say, hey, I want you to cover this film. To do that, you hit us up on social media or you email us over at
spitandpolished@gmail.com.
I say this because it's always great to have your picks, but we need some more picks on our list because we're hitting a bit of a lower number, but sadly, many of the films that we do have on the list right now are foreign films that we have yet to attain a copy of because they're a little bit difficult to find. So we are doing a foreign film yet again. We are doing one from our good friend, Dr. Rashesh. Dr. Reshes, Dre Eshes. Yeah. They've never told us if they're a doctor.
They never will. The thing I love most about Dr. Rashesh is that, you know, they comment on our episodes a lot.
I love that.
But they never comment on our confusion.
No, and I, and you know what? Never do it.
Never do it.
They have a what looks like an anime here for us to do. Josie, the Tiger and the Fish, if I've got that right. Josie. Okay. J-O-S-E-E. So I'm imagining Josie. The Tiger and the Fish, that's the 2010s. I have no familiarity with this. I don't know anything about it, never heard of it. I'm not familiar with the art style of it. It's not like a Penguin Highway where it's like, oh, I've seen the poster for that in a DVDs. No, nothing at all. Oh, it's a 2020 release, so more Ooh. More recent affair. But don't know a single thing. What about you? Anything for this?
I want to say it rings a bell, but I think it's just because I'm the one that put it on the list.
There you are. So everyone, make sure to check that film out for yourself in the meantime and come back with us as we talk about it when we return in 3 months' time. I'm kidding, of course. Bartek, where can people find us on the internet?
If you found us already, you can probably find us again. But if you haven't found us and you're listening to this anyway, you can find us on our Podbean, Spit and Polish Presents. You can find us on YouTube, Spit and Polish Presents. Our Facebook page, funnily enough, is also Spit and Polish Presents. On Twitter, our name is Spit and Polish Presents. Mm. I think Spit Polish Pre is the at thing.
At the at, but who cares?
Yeah, fair enough. Generally we're pretty easy to find if you search that. If you don't put the presents in, you might get a bunch of shoe shining stuff. So make sure you remember that P word.
Rate and review the podcast if you do want to, but if you don't, at least do it once. Just once. Give us a 5 stars. Yes.
It might not change our ranking on the top 80. Two men podcast.
I added Polish men in there.
No, then we'd be number one because I think everyone else is like American or something.
I have to check if the Polish podcast list have Polish podcasts with two men though. And now would we Ooh. Be top in that? I'll check it again.
Or if they even have like hosts with personalities.
Oh, if you're Polish,
like if it's just
you're
like
lacking personality,
like if it's just like an educational voice talking to you.
Fair enough. Well, I guess until next time, everyone, remember to be kind to each other. And this is the year of musicals for this podcast. We will get there eventually. If only Decision to Leave was a musical.
Yeah, I've had a couple in my head that I have to pick. We'll see. We'll see how well we go.
We've already done Grease 2, so you can't pick that again.
I think I made that joke literally last episode.